Welcome. Welcome. Nice to have you all here. What a great joy it is to be here together. Well, this is always one of my favorite events because it's Christmas. And it seems like one of the things that's easiest to forget about at Christmas is the Christ part, the Christ part. You know, in the midst of all the insanity we tend to ensue, that tends to ensue during this time, that's really a very, very profound time. So I've always been a lover of Jesus from the time I was a little kid. I was one of those people. Do you remember seeing, what was that movie? Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And remember at that part in the part in a particular point in the movie, there's a few of the main characters that start making these really kind of strange shaped, you know, like monolithic things. Richard Dreyfuss builds one right inside of his living room to the absolute horror of his wife, and there's a few other people that are just building these big like piles of dirt and then sort of molding them, and they don't even know what they're doing or why they're doing it or what's it all about. They only find out much later. And fortunately, I wasn't bringing in piles of dirt into my living. My mom wouldn't have stood for that for a second, you know. But really, from my whole young life, I had this tendency to, I would just sit there and doodle. And all of my doodles were either a cross, or a cross, and then a circle around the cross. So I used to literally, like, even in the bathtub where we'd have these, like, glass door that goes in front of the bathtub, and it gets all steamed up, and by the time I got out, you'd see these doodles, like, all over the glass where I could see in the steam. And so somehow this story was really deeply imprinted, even though, you know, my family wasn't much of a church-going family for the most part. I was one of those kids that just absolutely loved all those huge epics about the life of Jesus. You know, the Ten Commandments. It was like big. There was a time there, maybe 30, 35 years ago, where 40 years ago, where these big epics, these are, you know, religious epics, were sort of all the rage, and I just loved them, couldn't get enough of them. So somehow this was really a big part of my experience. And I think we all grow up, whether we, you know, whatever religion or no religion that we might grow up with, you can't grow up in Western culture without sort of being infused by this story of Jesus, right? In fact, it's the story that infuses our culture to an amazing, amazing degree. It wasn't until relatively recently that many of the arts broke out of doing strictly religious sort of things, like most paintings up till a couple hundred years ago, the vast majority of them were religious paintings, and they had to do with this story affected our whole cultural history, affected our politics. Kings and queens were subjected to this story, people of great power, everything. So in many ways, our entire Western culture has revolved around this story. Whether you believe in it or you don't believe in it, whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian or whatever you do, it's, if you really look at it, this story of the life of Jesus has had a huge, profound effect on our culture, art, music, politics, of course, religion, profound effect. And I think we can at times think that it doesn't have that big effect now with all the the sort of franchising and marketing about damn near everything. And yet, that's the core of that story is still with us. Now, I think what I grew up with was probably, I think, what a lot of you grew up with. I had this idea of this sort of culturally maintained idea of Jesus. And this culturally maintained idea of Jesus is really sort of more like Jesus the Good Shepherd, do you know? Which you find in, you know, the Gospel of Matthew and stuff. And Jesus is sort of this really nice guy that he's the shepherd. He brings people in and he helps people and he heals people. And so you have sort of the Good Shepherd kind of Jesus, which is basically the Good Shepherd kind of Jesus is a Jesus that sort of is a moral and ethical teacher. That's sort of what he does, which is what predominantly what churches do. They're moral and ethical teachers. That's the cultural agenda that they serve. Now, if you get deep inside of them, then you can start to touch upon something beyond the moral and ethical sort of teachings. But there's a type of Jesus who was sort of this moral ethical teacher. And this is the one that I think we kind of grow up with. This is the one we hear about the most. This is the one I think that's very attracted to people. The one that talks about the Beatitudes and, you know, comes up with all these nice prayers and all that stuff. And then, of course, we have a different Jesus. So you got a different Jesus in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John's Jesus is sort of a extraordinarily confident, fully developed spiritual maverick. I mean, right from the beginning of the story, you know, he is just oozing with confidence and certainty. And he makes, in many ways, the biggest claims. Those are the ones I think that we're most used to. That kind of Jesus is the one we're used to. Sort of the hero Jesus. So I can remember when I started, actually, this was some time back, maybe 15 years back or so, I started to actually read these Gospels. Do you know? To actually sit down and read it rather than hear about it, or search through the Bible for the red sections, which tell you what Jesus was supposed to have said. That's what I used to like to do. I don't want the damn story. Give me what the guy said. So I'd flip through and go to all the red sections, you know. That's supposed to be what he said. And then I actually sat down maybe 15 years ago and started to read some of these Gospels, and I was very, very surprised by what I read. Because what I found is the Jesus that I think culturally is supported, in which we talk about and religion tends to support, it's really hard to find that guy in the Gospels. It really is. You got to kind of be really selective about what you choose to listen to and what you choose to discard to come up with this Jesus that sort of fits into our culture, religious culture, and our political culture, and he kind of fits in there. It's sort of Jesus that isn't very disturbing to anybody, right? Which is sort of amazing that one could even pull this off. I mean, because the whole story, of course, is a guy who caused so much trouble that he got himself killed. Do you know, and how we came to this, you know, really nice good shepherd that loved people and was the, you know, the moral and ethical spiritual teacher, and they like put him on a cross for that? You know what I mean? It doesn't add up, really. And it's only when I start to actually read these stories, like I said, at first I was really quite surprised, because the Jesus in these stories is very different from the one we get culturally. And it's often different from the one we get through a lot of the churches. B- Because the truth is, of course, and we all do this, every one of us, myself included, we all make Jesus into the person that we want him to be. That's what we do. That's exactly what the gospel writers were doing too. They were using him to tell a story, to make a point. Now, I'm not going to get into whether how historically correct or incorrect it is, or whether he did all the things that it says they did. I think one of the biggest barriers we all have to like cracking this, in Zen we call this koan, this riddle of the life of Jesus, one of the biggest bit, which our culture as a whole has not cracked it, hasn't even come close to cracking it. 99% of our churches haven't cracked it. A few of the mystics along the way have managed to get inside of the reality of it, but not that many people, and I don't think any institution has managed to get inside of it and actually open it up and see what was really in there. So it seems pretty obvious that if we look at these Gospels, that they were actually, each one of them was depicting a different type of Jesus through the story. And many things about the stories, they borrowed from each other, and many things about the stories are completely contradictory. And what happened when is really, really all messed up. You know, like if you wanted to come up with a coherent narrative of four stories that kind of followed each other, you couldn't have done a worse job of it than to try to get these four stories, because they don't actually match up that well. They have certain parts of the stories that are the same, but they keep getting like, you know, one will put it near the end, the other will put it in the beginning. You know, they'll put stories all over the place, and there's not that much cohesion. That's one of the things that we're not taught either, is that actually these are very different stories. And they have very different agendas. To me, the most spiritually useful way to look at these stories is to look at them through sort of mythic eyes. Today, unfortunately, we have a very deep misunderstanding of what myth is. We have an understanding of myth which is completely different than people had 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. Now we think of myth almost as a lie. I'm telling this story, it's not true, you see, it's a myth, so it's not true. It's something you tell, it's like something you tell little kids, you know? We'll tell you this to make you feel better, this little myth, this little story. But that is not the historical definition of myth. That is not how people, up until relatively recently, the last few 200 or 300 years, have seen what myth is. Myth has been this way of communicating very, very deep truth, deep truths that you can't actually communicate in just a sort of a logical, rational presentation. They're too deep, they're too subtle, they're too profound. And so myth was created to communicate something extraordinarily profound and deep. Now, that's very different than the way we think of myth, don't we? We don't think of myth as communicating something very profound and deep and true. We just get hooked on, was it historically true or not? You see? As if the truth of something depended on whether something historically happened. You know, like we could agree that you were historically birthed on a certain day. You came into the world on a certain day, and you go out of the world on a certain day, and we could get your history nailed down and da-da-da-da-da. But how much would we know of you? It's like just getting the facts straight. But you can have your facts straight and be completely deluded about what those facts apply to. So when we look at these stories, it's so much more fascinating, interesting, if we can look at them through mythic eyes. Mythic eyes, we're not saying that they are or aren't true. We're just saying, look at it through mythic eyes just says, that's not the point. That's where the whole Christian thing has gotten hung up, literally snagged, hung up It's like walking around on one leg and hopping on one leg instead of two or four. Is because the argument becomes, how historical is it? And as soon as you look at it in that vein, you've killed it. You're back in the sort of a very rational, safe place. It's safe to argue about history, isn't it? This happened when? It did. I think it did. I think it didn't. You know, just, you'll never know. It was 2,000 years ago. There wasn't any video cameras. There weren't any recorders. Hell, there weren't even scribes to write down what was happening as it was happening, you see? So the one thing we don't know, that we know, is that we don't know. Which is a good thing, actually. The most amazing thing about this story is that it is a story. That's the amazing thing about the story of Jesus, is that it is a story. It's a teaching through a story. It's a very deep teaching in the terms of a story. It's very different from the life of Buddha. The life of Buddha, if you want to get the teaching, there's just volumes of what the Buddha is supposed to have said. Volumes. His life is, except from a few points of it that can be used as a good teaching, his life itself isn't the teaching. His teachings are the teaching. Right? Jesus is just the opposite. His life is the teaching. The story is the teaching. The story is what is the most important part. It's the story. And of course, to understand the story, the only way to understand the story is you have to start to experience what's in the story. Does that make sense? You have to experience where that story comes from, what's trying to be communicated through that story. So just to be a little contrarian, because if Jesus was anything, he was a contrarian. That's in the story. That you can't erase from the story. That's indelibly imprinted upon the story. So I want to tell you one of the stories that's most the least told story of all the gospel stories. And it's not necessarily my favorite. There's two favorites that I have. Everybody has their favorites, and if you're interested in it at all. My favorites are Mark and John. John, because it appeals to the mystics, and it's really has some nice things to say to mystics. And Mark, because Mark cuts deep to the bone. Mark is a totally uncompromising portrait of the spiritual path. So it's generally thought. When I say generally thought, it means like people generally agree. But I always go back to, we don't actually know because there weren't video cameras and tape recorders. So we don't actually know. But it's generally thought, for reasons I won't go into, that Mark was probably the earliest written of the four Gospels. Right? That they all borrowed from this general outline of Mark. In fact, when you read Mark, Mark is kind of reads much more like an outline. It's so brief. It's so pared down. It's so all the fat is cut away that it almost feels like an outline, even though it's a story. And I think by looking at that part of the story, we get a very different depiction than we commonly have. And if you remember, it's the story that's important. In Mark, in his own way, he's saying over and over and over and over and over, it's the story that's important. That's what's important. It's the story. It's the life. So the interesting thing about Mark's Jesus is there is no nativity scene. There are no wise men. There is no North Star. There is no Virgin Mary. There is none of that. Basically, the story starts with Jesus just shows up. Who knows what he was doing until he showed up? There's nothing that's written. He just shows up and he bumps into this guy, this sort of wild man, John the Baptist. Now, when I read about John the Baptist, he actually, his, not where he's coming from, but his features, the way he's depicted is actually very much like Bodhidharma, who brought Buddhism from India to China. At least we're told. That story has a lot of myth in it too. But what I mean by that is John the Baptist is, I mean, he's like wearing a camel hair shirt and he has a beard and he's kind of a man right out of the deep woods. He's kind of wild. I mean, really pretty wild. And he's, you know, baptizing people and saving them from their sins and dunking them in the river. And, you know, that's how, where all that got started. And he was on the outskirts. When if you read about what he was wearing and everything, he was a wild man. It was almost be like if he was, you know, a trapper on the frontier or something in this country, you know, very sort of wild looking, and he's bringing people down. So John the Baptist was a really fascinating character. His baptism was the baptism of water. Now, water is, in religious or spiritual teachings, water is the medium of law, covenant, right? Because John the Baptist was a Jew, right? So it's the medium, it's the transforming medium of law. Do this, don't do that. Thou shalt, the Ten Commandments. It's a whole perspective where you are constantly monitoring your behavior so your relationship with God is correct, right? So that's John. But John is like on the outskirts. His view is kind of what you might find within the temple, but he's kind of halfway between the old religion or the common religion and where Jesus is. He hasn't quite got there, but he's halfway. And he even says he has a prophecy. And by the way, I'm not going to be able to quote things very well because I have a terrible memory. And I may get things upside down and back to front, but that's okay because I'm looking at this mythically. So I always think these things are interesting if you can actually put yourself in the place of the characters. So you're not just listening to like a bedtime story, but you can actually put yourself standing in a river and saving souls and dunking people's head and baptize them in water, and your hair's long and you're all, you know, you got this grizzled look and your beard is all dirty and you're just sort of in tatters, and yet here you are doing this thing. You are charged with the evangelical kind of spirit, right? And he has this prophecy, this vision that somebody else is going to be coming along that he, of course, says, I'm not worthy even to tie his shoes. And sure enough, this is basically where the story starts. And Jesus shows up. And there's this guy. And he's spotted by John. John is halfway between the old religious view and something new. The old can't spot Jesus. That's what got him killed, because nobody could see. They couldn't see who he was. His own disciples couldn't see who he was, which I'll talk about in a little bit later. But this crazy man in this river, he could spot him. He knew who it was when he saw him. And it's interesting that a guy like Jesus would be baptized, because we tend to think he just came into the world knowing everything. So John baptizes Jesus. Down goes Jesus, water into the water, and he comes up. But when he comes up, he gets this. The Spirit descends upon him. Spirit descends upon him. And there's the image of the dove, you know, and all that. But there's this Spirit that descends upon him. This is a completely different baptism than John does. John's baptism is baptism of water. It's about the moral and ethical religious teaching. It's about that view. Jesus, when he receives that, he also instantly receives the baptism, or we would maybe call in modern spirituality, the initiation of Spirit. And that initiation began his entire life of teaching when he received Spirit. It came into him. And this experience of Spirit coming into somebody is that it very much can actually happen that way. It happened to me that way. I had the experience of Spirit coming into me. It may not make sense in non-dual circles and all that, but experientially, some of you have probably had it happen too. I can very distinctly remember the day that it happened, and I can distinctly remember thinking, oh no, that's it. My life is over. The life that whatever I thought I was doing, my trajectory that I had in mind has ceased. That's what I knew when that came in. I knew it's over. It's done with. My life is about something completely different. It's about whatever just came in. And I had no idea what it was. So I spent the next 2 or 3 years almost like I said it to myself, but I internally it almost felt like, you know, when you have somebody that's a little deranged and they're just sort of mumbling as they're, you know, a street person or something, they're mumbling, you can't really know what they're talking about. I would walk along constantly with mantra, and my mantra was, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? I knew better than to say it verbally. Because if I did, I would have literally, someone could have listened to me. In all my waking hours, I would be going, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is it? That many times, just for hours. Because I wanted to know, what got inside? What happened? How did my life change from one between the evening before and the morning I woke up? What in the hell happened? What got inside me? And what is this all about? So it can happen that way. One can have this sort of descending of something into you. And so right at the beginning of the story, what the story is telling us is that this is going to be a completely different kind of spiritual or religious story. This is a story about the Spirit. This is not the story about the law. This is not the Ten Commandments. Jesus is not going to go up a hillside and come down with Ten Commandments. That's good too. Those are fine too. You know, human beings, that's also is what our culture revolves around, those commandments, right? Those are part of those commandments. But this is sort of telling everybody right from the beginning, this guy is not like all the rest. This guy does not fit in. This guy is not going to be the preacher of moral, ethical law. That's not what he's here for. That's a baptism of water. This guy's been baptized in the Spirit. This is a completely, absolutely different being. Completely. Of course, as the story says, he disappears after that. He ends up in the desert, 40 days and 40 nights. And he's tempted with all the good stuff and with all the bad stuff. How deep should we go into this stuff? When when spirit wakes up in somebody or descends upon them, but it, when it becomes activated, that's a very, very potent force. When Jesus says, if you do not bring forth that which is within you, what you do not bring forth will kill you, will destroy you. If you do bring forth what is within you, that which you bring forth will save you. That's spirit, to bring it forth. But to bring it forth is a very, very tricky, in many ways dangerous thing to do, because it's a tremendous, tremendous power. It's a lot of power that spirit has. And so, of course, this power drives Jesus out into the middle of the desert. And that power activates shadow energies. It activates them because it is not them. It is the power of light. Pure grace. But anytime you get an infusion of pure grace, what that pure grace will do at some point, will activate its opposite. That makes sense? It just happens. And I'm sure a lot of you have probably experienced that. You can have a wonderful moment of spiritual clarity, and then often, for a while, at a later time, you'll have the equal and opposite sort of boomerang effect, right? So you'll be totally open, and at some point, as you'll become equally as closed as you were open. It's really common. And then, of course, then people wonder what happened, and what did I do wrong, and how do I get that beautiful state of clarity back, and you know, all those kind of ways that we move with it. But what really is happening is light activates shadow. It's just sort of one of the spiritual law, you might call it, just the way things happen. So here he is up in the desert, and it's activating shadow, not only his shadow personally, but as soon as you dwell in the level of spirit, you're dwelling on a much bigger level than personal, so then you have the collective shadow. In Christianity, the collective shadow is the devil, right? We put it out there. So we don't have to, you know, it's just the bad guy out there. That's not a particularly useful way of understanding it. So he gets these temptations, and he's tempted by all the normal things, you know, lust, power, greed. You know, and then the tempter kind of starts to say, well, you're a hot shot. Let me see you create something with your spiritual powers. And he doesn't go for that. And you've all probably heard the story, very similar to what the Buddha underwent under the Bodhi tree. Instead of a devil tormenting him, it was Mara, both tempting with the good stuff and with very scary, frightening experiences. So you could say he passes the test. In him, he doesn't have any will to grasp and abuse what he's been shown, nor does he have the will to, nor is he afraid of its opposite, because he knows that its opposite is powerless. You know, he has to run for the opposite to be empowered. So if you want to empower fear, the greatest way to empower fear is to try to avoid it. The more you try to avoid, the more fear you have, because it's actually empowering the fear. It's giving it this vital energy source. So he knows by the time he comes out of the desert, he thinks he knows What this is, what his next step. He goes about and finds his 12 disciples. Now, the 12 disciples is a sort of an interesting thing, because it goes on this really important motif in the story. And by the way, what's this story about? This story is about spiritual awakening. Okay? That's what this story is about. If you understand it correctly, you understand that he is living out what you undergo internally. He's not teaching you about it. He's not telling you about it. He's living it out, right? And once you've gone through it, that's one of the fun parts about the story, because once you've gone through it, when you read the story, you can't miss it. If you haven't gone through it, you can read the story and you can't find it. You can't find like what it's really about. But once you've gone through it, you read the story or hear the story, then you know, immediately you know, oh, this story is about a full, mature awakening. That's what this story is. That's what it's talking about. It's not teaching you about it. It's not telling you how to do it. In this, the story, the life is it. If that makes sense. The story is the teaching, which is very unique in spiritual literature, where the story is the teaching. Usually the teaching is the teaching. But Jesus doesn't give a hell of a lot of good teaching. I mean, he gives some, you know, some nice stuff, you know. But for the most part, you know, love your neighbor and put God first, you know, and you know, there's a few things that he sprinkles out there, but for the most part, his story is the teaching. So he gets these 12 together, and these 12 he thinks are going to be his insiders, you know, the inside crew. They're going to be the ones that he gives the real stuff to, that he dedicates himself to. These are going to be the 12 that are going to get it. You see, they're going to get it spiritually. And they're going to go on and do what they do. Which, if you read Mark, they never get it. So first he gets these 12 disciples together because he thinks they're going to get it, and he's going to have this insider's teaching thing. And to the people on the outside that aren't these 12, he teaches in parables. And he says very overtly, I'm teaching them in parables so that they won't get it. That's why I'm teaching them in parables. You insiders, you already get it. So this is like backwards logic, right? Now, if you read it, don't believe, if you read the story, he actually says that in his words. I'm teaching these things in parables so that they don't get it. Fascinating, isn't it? The Savior is teaching so that people don't get it. It's sort of like a Zen master, though, telling you koans. A Zen master is telling you, giving you a koan, because he knows you're not going to get it. You're going to delude yourself with the koan, but through deluding yourself with the koan, if you keep at it, you might break through it, right? So it's a way of it's not that he doesn't want them to get it ever. It means he doesn't want them to get it here in their head, right? That's why he doesn't just come out and tell it to them straight, because then they'll just have a bunch of nonsense in their head. He gives them a parable, and he knows if they can actually understand, the only way to understand these things is if you get it spiritually. If you don't get it spiritually, you won't understand it. And if you don't get it spiritually, Jesus doesn't even want you to understand it. You see, so the only way to understand it is to have an essential insight into the ground of being. So he first tries parables. The funny thing is, I mean, it's not funny. It's, at least to me, I find most things funny, even terrible things sometimes. One of the interesting things is, you know, when he talks about his very first, or one of the first parables, which is really like one of the most obvious of them all. The sower and the seed, you know, and his parable, if the sower is, you know, casting seed, and you know, if it drops on stony ground, you know, it sprouts, but it has nowhere to for its roots to go, so almost immediately it dies. If you cast it on thorny ground, then it's sort of the same thing. It might it opens and it grows, but it dies too. You know, it's only when it's cast on fertile ground that the seed can actually take root and sprout and grow. So it's his way of saying, actually, he's talking about spiritual teaching. He's talking about the receptivity. Are you receptive? Different levels of receptivity. It's kind of very similar to when Ramana Maharshi was asked about different people engaging in the teachings, and he said, well, some are like really, really wet grass. You got to throw a lot of matches into the grass. Some of them are a little drier, you know, four or five, maybe a dozen matches. And there are those who are completely dry grass. One match and the whole field goes ablaze. It's sort of, it's a very sort of similar thing. The ironic part is in the story, he even goes back and he basically says, you know, I told this parable because, you know, we don't want them to understand, not until they can have a true understanding. But you, all of you on the inside, you guys understand. What he found out immediately when they opened their mouths was they didn't understand. Which was really disappointing to him. He could be quite sharp and quite cutting in his the way he talked to his disciples. Very, very sharp, very, very cutting. And I think it was at that time, really early on, he must have realized, uh-oh, my insiders don't know anything. Being on the inside isn't actually any better than being on the outside. In that particular gospel, you find then him teaching in parables disappears. He stops teaching in parables. He's not working, and these guys aren't getting it anyway. The ones who get it in the story, get it, I mean spiritually awaken, are the ones that aren't supposed to get it. It's really interesting. The insiders, all those 12, they're supposed to get it, but none of them actually do get it. And man, when you get to the passion, it's really clear they don't get it. They really don't get it. Right? One of the first people to get it is this guy, Legion. This guy called Legion, right? And Legion is just full of negative spirits. And Legion is crazy. Legion walks around the forest just screaming and yelling to himself. You know, like I said, you might find someone like that, you know, on the corner in almost any corner of San Francisco begging money. You know, I mean, really just in a deep state of delusion. And this was, and he was frightening and he was scary. And you get the feeling that he can be quite violent, and he was tormented. But Legion shows up to Jesus, you know? And Jesus casts out all the evil spirits. And the next thing you know, Legion gets it. And so he gets it. Not one of the disciples. The crazy guy. He was the crazy guy of the town. Nobody wanted around. He was on the periphery. He was just completely uncontrollable. He gets it. And of course, Jesus casts those evil spirits out into the waters, into the sea. today, I think you could think of, I think a lot of people unfortunately think of something like evil spirit. They just think of that. I don't know how they think of it. But in a way that's not very helpful, that's for sure. A more modern, a little bit more updated version might be evil or dark energies. Very, very dark, dark energies that had, and he had many, many dark energies inside of him. And Jesus immediately goes, says, you know, go away. Go out there. Don't tell anybody. So you can imagine if you're one of the 12 disciples and your teacher is constantly berating you for not getting it, for not understanding him. The people in his inner circle don't understand him. The people on the outside, the general population, doesn't understand him. Nobody understands him, but the first one to understand him is this crazy guy. And this crazy guy becomes like a shining. You know, he's just shining. He's just glowing. He's totally at peace, totally calm, absolutely radiant. This guy did have the one qualification that, of course, in Jesus' teaching part that he talks about. Seek God first above all else, with all your heart and all your mind, your entire being. Seek God first. Legion was seeking first. Things were so bad for him that he had no other fallback. Seeking a good life, there wasn't a good life. Seeking to make money, crazy people don't make much money. At least not that crazy. You know, all of his options were closed. He had no other option. He had this one option. And the interesting thing, he could spot it when he saw it. When Jesus came, Legion knew what he was. He knew what he was. When everybody else, not only didn't they get transformed, but they didn't even know who he was. Some of the disciples, by the way, would often refer to him as Messiah. And in the Gospel of Mark, if you wanted to really piss Jesus off, call him the Messiah. He would basically tell them, no, 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 no. That is not what I am. Interesting that that's what we're left with, isn't it? See, because a lot of his disciples, they thought he was the Messiah that was prophesied, right, for the Jewish people. And of course, you know, that became the story. But that's the interesting thing when you read these things. When you read Mark, you hear him criticizing his disciples for suggesting that he was the Messiah. He would ask them, who am I? Who do you think I am? You're the Messiah. You know, he'd just be pulling his hair out. Like, no, I'm not the Messiah. You see, the difficulty that those 12 disciples had are the same difficulty that people have today with this story. Is the disciples saw him as just another person in the line of the moral, ethical teacher. That's what they saw. That's who they expected him to be. That's not who he was. He was a teacher of enlightenment. That's the kind of that's what he was teaching. That's the only thing that he was teaching. And that was very hard for people to grasp. Very, very hard for people to grasp. What is that? What is that? There's a few other people he heals. There's a few other people who get it. There's a few other people who recognize what he is. One of my favorite scenes is when he's in the scene, he came over to someone's house for dinner, had the disciples along and some other people, and this woman comes into the house. And she breaks open this bottle of perfume. It's the kind of perfume that at that time would cost a year's wage to have that bottle of perfume. It's been thought that she very well may have been a prostitute. After all, how does a woman back then, how does a woman get enough money to buy this and carry it around? And she's sensual. And she is everything that terrifies these disciples. Right? She's sensual, she's sexy, she is emotional, right? She comes in and kind of dances around him and starts pouring this perfume over his head. A bottle of perfume, of oiled perfume that would cost a year's wage. And just imagine a year today, a year of your money, you are pouring it over someone's head. Right? She's anointing him. She's anointing him because she recognizes him, right? So this woman, possibly of ill repute, we don't really know, but she could be. And she is anointing this guy because she sees who he is. She knows what he is. And in the face of him, she's also celebrating him. She's also ashamed of herself. You know, and at one point she starts wiping his feet with her hair. So she's lowered herself in this shame. She sort of starts out ecstatic almost and sensual, and she ends up wiping his feet with her hair. And one of the disciples gets upset and basically says, "That was a year's worth of perfume. How dare you be so to squander money like that? How dare you do that? And what are you doing? Get away from this teacher. Get away from my teacher." You know, dancing around the teacher and pouring oil and wiping his feet with her, you know, and the whole thing. And he's just abhorrent, right? He'll later go on to build churches. he's actually the one. And this is one of many times that Jesus got upset and really, really laid into his disciple about this, because he knew what she was experiencing. She knew what he was. And she was so unlimited in her expression, so unabashed, you see, which is very sort of unspiritual, isn't it? In the way we're thought of spirituality, sort of we're all safe and we're all proper and we're, you know, we all, it's hushed tones all the time, you know. And now, this could have been somebody that was just sort of worshiping him. And they would have been worshiping their idea of him. But he spotted that this was different. And this woman would become really like his 13th disciple. Really. And one of them that actually got it. Just going at full, I'll zip ahead for a quick moment in the story. You know, at the cross, she's one of the women that are at the cross. All the men split. The 12 disciples, nowhere. They don't even know the guy, so they say. Don't know him, haven't met him, disown him, sorry. But you see, in these first, in these two healing accounts, these weren't just like, I mean, she didn't necessarily need like a physical healing, but she received a spiritual healing. In these accounts, however, these were desperate people. Desperate people. These were the people that he preached about. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all else will be added unto you. With all your heart and all your soul, with everything you got. What the way that translates is blood dripping desperation. Sustained. Do you know? That's what he's talking about. And that's why these people end up being transformed. Legion goes from extraordinarily deluded, seemingly very crazy, to radiant, calm, serene. This woman actually starts her transformation process, is begun at that moment. There is the essential turning in her heart. She's sort of a symbol of spirituality done through the heart. So there was other people that he healed, of course, but even at certain times, he would even kind of say, gosh, do I have to do this? Like, you just want me to heal? And then a few times he'd go, okay, bring them to me and I'll heal them. So he quickly realized this healing thing that he was so good at. He had this power, because there's lots of power that comes with spirit, that people were seeing the healing, but they were looking past what he was all about, what he really wanted to give them. He wanted to give them a spiritual healing. So, of course, I'm skipping over a lot of this story, but because we have limited time, but not too long after that, he is called up to the top of a mountain, and he brings three of his disciples with him. And there's these growing clouds, huge, dark, rolling clouds quickly start to cover the sky. And the disciple, again, that will later go on to build churches, basically says, oh, we've got to make a shelter to protect ourselves from the rain. So right off the bat, he's missing what's about to happen. He's only can think in conventional, rational terms, you know. A storm, we got to take cover, you know. And Jesus, like, you don't know what's going to happen. And of course, what comes out of this cloud is his baptism by fire. By fire, he is left shining. That's the transfiguration. Right? Jesus is on top of that mountain, and he's just shining. There wasn't going to be a rainstorm. There was going to be this baptism by fire. And that was it was just absolutely radiant. He became for a moment just absolute radiance. He just became a light for a short period of time. He just became complete radiance. And even with that, even witnessing that, being right next to him, those three disciples, the only thing they could come up with was to be terrified by it, which is a sort of a motif that runs through the disciples over and over and over and over in the Gospel of Mark, is they're constantly being terrified of Jesus, frightened of him. Because he's someone of immense power, they know there's something amazing in this being. This being had such charisma, something that he could just go down in a very short order and gather disciples up from, you know, fishermen and just say, kind of, you're coming and you're coming and you're coming. There's something about him that made people go, okay, I will drop everything. I will leave my family, my wives, my kids, my occupation. I will drop everything and I will follow you. Obviously, there was something amazing about this being, about this person. But as they get close, the closer they get to him, as the story unfolds, the more afraid they become of him. Because they cannot understand what he is, who he is. So he ends up with the transfiguration. Is this? It is a baptism of fire. And again, this is an experience, a deep, spiritually transforming experience that one can go through. An experience that is very much like that, where you literally can feel like you're on fire. You can be sitting in a room like this, quite safe, and you literally feel like you're on fire, like everything inside and outside of you is burning, like you would want to jump into a swimming pool or something. And it's thought of in certain spiritual circles. Of course, I'm talking about this through a Christian lens, right? The way that I think makes most sense. So his sense of himself changes each time he has these initiations. At the water, initiated by spirit, it changes his idea of who he is, of what he is. When he experiences transfiguration again, his idea of what he is undergoes a change, an alteration. It's a type of spiritual awakening, because an awakening is change of identity. Thinking, feeling, having this entire sense of your one thing, and then you awaken out of that into something else. And then that something else becomes what you think you are. And that, then you wake up out of that. And so it goes. Right? Usually, well, the mistake that most people make is when they have one awakening, they go, I got it. That's it. Okay, now I understand what the whole thing is about. Which, of course, anytime we have a major shift of identity, it feels that way. It feels like there's nothing else. This is it. Game over. You know, there's nothing else to see. Reality, every time you touch into reality, that's the way it feels. But this is something that the story is also showing you, that there is not just one awakening. There are many, there are different varieties of this shift. So in this transfiguration, his idea of who he is undergoes a transformation. Again, mirroring the spiritual journey of all beings. Mirroring it, living it out. Instead of teaching about it, living it. The story is the story of someone living it. He also, right about that time, right after that, he starts to get premonition of what his life is about. He starts to get, it suddenly starts to dawn on him. Oh, this is what my life is about. You know, before, he went out very quickly and started teaching, and he thought it was going to be about gathering disciples and having these insiders and initiating them all with the truth, and they'll all end up enlightened, and then he'll send, you know, do all this stuff. Well, that didn't work out. Then he does the, you know, the parable thing, and nobody understands, nobody gets that. Then he does the healing thing, and a few people get it, the desperate ones get it, but the problem is it leaves everybody just wanting a healing, a physical healing. Not what he's really about. So that doesn't quite work out. Now he undergoes this transfiguration. Now he knows. He knows now. It comes to him. He has sort of the eyes of prophecy knowing the future, and now he knows what he's really doing there. And the story takes on a very different tone when he starts to know what he's doing there. He knows his life is this, that his life itself is the spiritual journey. You see, the paradox is even though he comes in, as it were, completely awake, his life was going to be about literally the living of life was going to be the mirror. It's going to be the expression of the entire of spiritual unfolding. So even though he knows, you could say he knows the end, he is going to have to go through the whole thing in these graphic terms, right? So after this transfiguration, the story takes has a different feel to it. It shifts energy a bit. It becomes more sober. Now it's not necessarily about huge healings. Those are pretty much over. He's not telling any more parables. He's not, trying to gather lots of people. Now his mood gets very, very internalized because now he knows. Now he knows. Right? He really knows. And of course, knowing that, knowing what he knows, it's disturbing. So shortly after that, he ends up in the Garden of Gethsemane, and I can't remember the words, but it's like his spirit was very heavy. And so he's going to go pray in the garden, and he asks his disciples if they would stay awake, kind of be with him, stay awake with him. And he goes into the garden and he starts to pray. And his prayer is basically, Father, can you take this cup from my lips? Do I really have to do this? Do I really have to be crucified and die and all this? Is this really the way it has to go? And when you read the story, he's on his hands and knees in the garden, probably in tears. This is somebody who's kind of coming half unglued. He's really scared of having to go through this. And at this moment, this extraordinarily potent, important moment, he goes to his disciples who are supposed to take, hold vigil with him. Hold vigil with him that night, of all nights. And they couldn't stay awake. So he went home and he woke them up, and he's, gosh, can't you guys stay awake? This is a huge moment for him. This is probably the biggest moment of his life as far as a heavy moment, a difficult moment. And he goes back to the garden, and of course the whole thing ensues again. Then they go back to sleep. Now you would assume they actually want to stay awake, right? They're not unlike you or anybody else. If this is the person you're following, it's like, and he says, look, I really need you to be with me. Your instinct is going to try to be with him, right? With everything you have. But they can't. They go to sleep a second time. Something, some force is constantly pulling them back to sleep. Happens a third time. He comes back to them. They've fallen asleep again. They can't stay awake at the crucial, crucial, crucial hour. At that, I wrote this one part down because it was very, I think it was, this is what it was. The third time, he doesn't even try to wake them up. He just says, sleep on forever. See, at that moment, he knew in a way that crystal clear, He knew them. He knew they didn't end up having the capacity, the capability that he had hoped. His insiders didn't work out. And he says, sleep on forever. It's a way that he's communicating their nature. They're asleep. And they're so weighed down by their view, by the world, by the state of consciousness they're in, that in the presence of this radiant being, even when he's in great distress, they literally can't stay awake. I have seen this happen, by the way. I've literally seen it happen. I've had people, when things were very, very small, who literally could not stay awake when I was talking to them. They just couldn't do it. It's not even that they were tired. But there's something in the structure of the old self that one of the ways it defends itself is it just goes to sleep. It just goes to sleep, you know, and it just can't not go to sleep. So some people, when they get in very deeply charged spiritual environments, they'll literally have a very hard time staying awake. And that's what his disciples were dealing with. They just couldn't stay awake. And so he saw, okay, sleep on forever. He finally sort of, it was another letting of all nights. How would you like that be the night where you just know my own disciples? Oh God. Of all nights, right? But he saw their nature and he just saw this too I'm going to have to let go of. This also. No expectation. So you can feel in the story, I know one person who wrote about this story, which I really loved, he called it a dark saying. Because it is sort of a dark story in some ways. As you follow the trajectory of it, it starts out sort of triumphant, and then it kind of goes, you know. And so at that garden, of course, he realizes he's all alone. It's completely him and nobody else. He's all alone. Now, this does a little side thing. One of the interesting things is in that garden, there is the presence of someone else dressed in white. Mark never says who it is. Different people think it was different. You know, they take their guess of who they think it might be. But Mark never says who he is, how he got there, or what he was doing there. It's just someone dressed in white. And of course, that person, they're awake. They're not going to sleep. So it's like having this stranger, almost like an apparition, that is holding vigil with you. But they do it at a distance. This person never comes close, never joins necessarily. They're just on the periphery, shows up. This same person will actually show up later in the tomb when Jesus dies. He'll be the person that's sitting there next to the empty tomb, telling the women when they enter, don't be afraid. Again, you don't know where the person came from. You don't know who the person is, just dressed in white, standing there, telling everybody it's all going to be okay. You know, so it's this sort of very calming presence. It's almost like a counterweight in the story, where the story is like gaining momentum and steam, and it's getting sort of more turbulent and turbulent and turbulent. And at times, there's just this being dressed in white that shows up every once in a while, right? Holding vigil, you might say. Now, I think that a lot of people in this room have had their own moments spiritually when you experience your aloneness. And there's different ways of spirit of feeling alone. There's sort of a psychological way in the ego of feeling alone. That's kind of feeling lonely. There's many levels of it. There's also this very deep existential aloneness, which if one goes all the way through it, that's what turns into oneness. But when you go through this sort of doorway of being very, very, you feel absolutely alone. And so that's what he's encountering here. Absolute aloneness, nobody to understand him, nobody to lean on. When the crucial hour comes, they can't even stay awake. And so in this garden, you know, in the middle of the night, in this desperate prayer, you know, and then at the end of it, not thy will, my will, but thy will be done. So one of the interesting things about the whole Jesus story, I think, which connects with so many people, is that this Jesus, as portrayed, is both human and divine. And I've noticed that in almost every single story, there are some exceptions, but in many of the stories that are around of the divine being, their humanity is almost always completely wiped out of the picture. So the divine being never has a bad day, never has a problem, is never desperate, never anything. It's the truly enlightened person is just like the Buddha, sitting serenely on their cushion all the time, right? That depiction, of course, points to something essential. It points to the essential nature of our own being. But also, all the humanity is sort of wiped out of it, right? But in the Jesus story, there's a lot of humanity in this person. Right? There's desperation, there's frustration, there's anger. I didn't even talk about the kicking over the money changer tables, because I think I did that last year, you know. But you know, this isn't a Buddha kind of guy, right? This isn't somebody that never gets ruffled. He gets ruffled, and he gets ruffled in many, many, many different ways. Which, of course, is one of the other things I found like surprising when I read it. I thought, I never heard about this guy in church. I never saw him in the big spiritual epics. He always had it totally together. You know, this isn't the guy I've heard about. You know, except for little tidbits here and there. You know, you'll get, okay, he had this moment of difficulty. But for the most part, you know, he's got it completely together. So one of the interesting parts of the story, there's really a couple. Of course, I don't have to tell you all the story of when Judas comes and betrays him. And the Last Supper, you know, what the whole idea of the Eucharist came out of, the Last Supper, of the eating of the bread and the drink and the wine for his blood. And now, if you're sensitive, a good ritual, which I think the Eucharist is one of the best that I've seen or have done. I actually did the whole Eucharist thing before I knew I wasn't supposed to in a Catholic church. Not being Catholic, you know, you're not supposed to. But I didn't know. far as I could tell, nobody seemed to, Jesus didn't seem to mind. After I've read the Gospels, I think Jesus would have been the one in the back going, God, go on up, kid. Go on up. Just don't worry about it. Take the bread, the wine. Come on. But there are these rituals that some of them, not all of them, but some rituals hold really tremendous amount of power. I think the Eucharist is one of the rituals that hold a tremendous amount of power, a power that's completely independent of who's doing it. So it's nice when you have somebody who's performing, a priest or whatever, performing their ritual, who brings a really beautiful, profound energy themselves. But the nice thing about the ritual is it doesn't depend on that. It has a power in and of itself. And that's the real reason for ritual, is to connect you with that power, connect you with that ritual, is to connect you with the Christ. Which might be a good time to talk about the difference between Jesus and Christ. Because Jesus and Christ were... Jesus was the human. Christ was the all. Christ is what we share in common. Everybody has the nature of the Christ within them. Other people gave him that title, do you know? But to know the difference between the Christ and Jesus is, I think, the only way to actually be able to enter into the deep mystical roots of Christianity. If you don't get that, which most don't, then the whole thing remains kind of confusing. Because when Jesus refers to himself, he's always referring to Christ. And like he was saying, these things and more shall be yours. There's many references to when he's basically saying, this that I am, you are. The Christ is what we all share in common. The Christ is our essential nature, our spiritual identity. Now, it can be called lots of different. In Christianity, it's called the Christ. In Buddhism, it's called Buddha nature. Every religion would have its own name for it. But it's that which all beings hold in common. That's what someone like Jesus incarnates for, to bring that energy of the Christ in and make it available to people. Jesus the man had good days and bad days, difficult times and easy times. He could be angry, he could be peaceful. Jesus the Christ is that which is ever shining. That's what gives him his, it's what he is. That's what gives him all of his force and all of his authority. And boy, when you open yourself up to that power, that's the power that's inherent in Christianity. It's a very specific, for lack of a better word, energy. It's a very specific. It feels a very specific way. It's just oozing out of all of Christianity, no matter how much they try to cleanse Christianity of it. They don't know they're doing that, by the way. But it's still there. It's the beauty of it. There's this incredibly powerful presence that is, that's the Christ. That's what he was trying to get people to see. That's who he found out he was. That's who he was trying to get you to find out you are. That's why he could have a human moment, and then always the Christ would then come through. He could fall. He could fall to his knees. He could kind of break down, knowing that my not only does my Christ nature have to go through this, which it's fine. It has no problem whatsoever. But my human nature has to go through this. Because without the human nature going through this, there's no form. You see, there's no story. There's no happening. It's the human nature that actually, you know, there's a man and he goes through this and this happens and that happens and that happens. So the human nature going through this was absolutely vital. The human nature had real reservations about it. The divine nature had none. It just, because it is forever untouched. It's that part in you that's always forever untouched. It's always the same. It's the part in you that anybody, whether they're spiritual or unspiritual, there's an intuitive way of recognition that there's something about you now that's exactly the way it ever was. There's something about you now that's the same as when you were 2 years old and 15 and 20 and 30. There's something about you that's the same. Everything else in your experience has changed. Your looks have changed. Your mind has changed. Your emotions change. Your belief system change. Your place in life, your status, everything is changing, but there's something that isn't. And on a very mundane level, it's that which allows people to have a sense of who they've always been. You know, when you look at a photograph and point at it and go, I was 4 years old. See that one in that picture. And when you say that, I was 4 years old. I was there. I did that. I remember that. But if you really look at something about that 4 years old and something about recognizing yourself there, there's a recognition. Now, until we get spiritually clear, we won't know what that is. We won't be able to have a really clear sense of it, but you'll know there is a recognition. There is something about me that's been the same. That's what he's trying to... That's what his life's trying to show people. Oh, we can't end this without Judas, of course, can we? There's two traditions of Judas. One of them, which is in the Bible, which is the one I'll talk about because the other one's not in the Bible. It doesn't mean it's not worthy. It's actually really interesting. But the one version of Judas we know, the great betrayer. There's another tradition of Judas that also was, there was some written about at the same time period, but it didn't make it in the Bible, where Judas is basically the hero, where Judas is the one person that got it. And so Jesus could trust Judas to help him follow out his plan, his destiny, right? So Judas had to go, he had to betray him, and then he had to come, you know, so this whole thing could actually happen. That's another view. I just want to let, for those who have never heard that, that view is out there, and it was out there at the time the Gospels were being written. It didn't get chosen. But there are some, you can make some really good cases why, how it could be that way. I mean, you know, Judas is sitting right next to Jesus at the Last Supper, and Judas comes and kisses him at the, when he betrays them, you know, the one I kiss that'll show you. Why not just that guy? Do you tend to go up and kiss the person you're really upset with and you really want to get them in trouble? You don't tend to go up and go, that one, you know, but nonetheless. So there's another tradition of Judas, which is, it's quite fascinating. But the one that's in the gospel story is also very fascinating, of the great betrayer. Because in that story, Judas, what he holds, the energy he holds, the part he's playing, again, if you look at it sort of mythically or spiritually, Judas is the person who recognizes, he comes closer probably than any of the other disciples to recognizing what Jesus is. If you read story, if you go through the story, Judas is in many ways the most, seems to be at certain times the most advanced one. The problem is for Judas is Jesus keeps, the presence, the Christ presence in Jesus is a continual, unending reminder of what he can't find in himself. So when he sees this person, the only thing he can think is, that's who I'm not. I'm not that. I'll never be that. That's not for me. Not in a million years. I'm so far away from that. And there's this sort of this dichotomy is, you see, he has to know Jesus better than the other disciples, even to feel that way. You see what I mean? To feel that way, you have to see into his nature, see what he is, to then be able to reflect and go, can I find that inside me? The other 11, they're just confused. You know, they're trying the best they can, bless their hearts. They're not bad people. They're for the most part, very sincere. They really want to know this guy. They're grateful. I mean, of course, if you've left everything and follow him, they're very committed. But Jesus is just too painful of a reminder for Judas. And so he has to lash out at what he doesn't think he can ever be. It shows the existential lack in him in such a powerful and painful way. It mirrors it for him that he just can't take it anymore. And this happens in spirituality too. If you're not ready for it, it tends to just mirror who you don't think you are. And if that gets really caught, really powerful, it can start to, you know, destroy you. And if as it starts to destroy you, it can turn at a certain point, because ultimately ego wants to survive, so it can destroy you to the point, and then it turns and it becomes malicious. Now it wants, it's either I get destroyed or you get destroyed. One of us being destroyed, it's going to be you. So this is taking an experience that people have, but of course, in these stories, it's taking the experience and pushing it to the extreme, right? So that nobody can miss it. That's what these kind of deep, spiritually encoded mythic stories do. They, through an actual story, they push it to such an extreme that it's kind of like nobody could miss it now, even though it seems like most do. But it doesn't mean that I think most people at a certain point in your life, lots of people can actually find that kind of energy, maybe to a much less degree, but that most people can find or remember that kind of pain when they put themselves, when they try to compare themselves to something that they think is far above them. It's very painful, isn't it? Really, really painful. It ties into the sense of insufficiency, of shame, of lack, of all of that. This, when actually the radiance, that's not what it's intending to do. Actually, what the radiance is saying constantly is, you too. This is what you are. You may have these terrible ideas about yourself, these absolutely excruciating ideas about yourself and feelings, but those aren't you. This is you. That's what the radiance is trying to remind everybody of. This is you, and the only thing that gets in the way is your belief
that you're something different. It's the only thing that gets in the way. See?
But someone like Judas, this excruciating inner turmoil that a lot of people experience at some point in their spiritual lives, and hopefully they break through it, is pushed to the extreme, so he now, it turns in him and becomes malicious, right?
It doesn't want to be destroyed, so it destroys.
Which is just not a Judas thing. Of course, that's why Jesus lost his life, right? Because there was a whole lot of people that didn't want to lose their power and their position and their viewpoint and their ideology and all that. And a whole lot of different people didn't want to lose that. And so he eventually destroyed, got him destroyed. What we got? 20 minutes.
No, you don't.
Oh, I'm over. Oh, 5 o'clock. Thank you, Terry. I'll tell you, those of you who might have been at Santa Cruz a few days back when I went 45 minutes over, no, my time thing is not working. It really is. An hour feels like a minute. Okay, that's a pretty good place to end, though, huh? It ends up good, don't worry. Well, kind of, yeah. Anyway, nice to be here with you.